ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And in this first episode of 2018, I'm rejoined by guest Diana Bosch as we recount our top three classic film discoveries of 2017.
It is the beginning of a new year, 2018, and it's time to look back at the year that was. We are doing another installment of my top I think we're doing a five this episode. It was top three last year. Classic film discoveries of 2017. Looking at the films that we appreciated or stars that we noticed, look at how classic film affected us. I am joined by the luminous Diana Bosch, who you might remember being on the podcast way back in 2016 on episode 10 when we talked about Splendor in the Grass. Diana, how are you?
I'm good, Kristen, and it should be noted that this is the first year we actually met because I went to the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival this year for the first time.
So that's
that was
right.
A really great time.
Yeah, Diana and I were roommates.
Yeah, it was awesome. It feels like forever ago. It's crazy.
Now we're just a couple short months from the next TCM Film Festival. Let's dive right into our classic film discoveries of 2017. I went with films, but you went with a lot of actors that you discovered this year. So why don't you throw out one of your first five picks?
One of the great things about the TCM Festival is the exposure to films that you may not have checked out before. And for me, it was pre-code. Now, pre-code was a genre that I would say like dipped a toe in. Like I've seen a lot of the Barbara Stanwyck films, but I never really went beyond that. And I had no idea what I was missing. Because pre-code is the best.
It really is.
It's incredible. And so I went to see Cock of the Air, one of the last films I saw at the TCM Fest. It was a Billy Dove, Chester Morris film that had been newly restored and discovered. And I was sitting next to Danny Reed, who runs Precode.com. It's a wonderful resource. It was just so great to meet him in person. And I just told him I wanted to see this because I've heard so much about it, and I've actually never really gotten immersed in pre-code. It was so great to chat with him, and I'm so glad I did because he gave me like a crash course then and there and told me which actors and actresses he really enjoyed. When I got him back home, I just started trying to find pre-codes if they were airing on TCM or anywhere else, and I had been watching a lot of Joan Crawford ones and Clark Gable and Jean Harlow, which led me to Franchot-Tone. And I didn't realize Franchot-Tone's divisive in the community. I don't really know why. I think a lot of people just kind of forget about him because of his marriage to Joan Crawford, but he was in every movie I watched and I just hadn't heard about him. He had a day on Summer Under the Stars. And I just devoured all these movies. It just became a thing. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to write about this on the blog because I really enjoy him. It's hard because he kind of plays the same character, like a rich playboy who's kind of a jerk. And then you realize he's wonderful and a heart of gold, or he's a rich playboy who's wonderful, but he's not cool enough. So your main character goes for the bad boy and then ends up with Franchot-Tone. Very bizarre. Didn't realize he had the type. What was so great about Summer Under the Stars is they showed a lot of later films of his and films where he was actually billed as a star versus the third guy. I also watched his television appearances. He was on a great episode of The Twilight Zone called The Silence, and then an Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode, which had Mary Astor, which I thought was so great because in his heyday, he had worked with every perfect, wonderful leading lady of the time. And Mary Astor was one of them, but they didn't have the chance to act in a film. But then they were on this Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode that was also really gripping. I just really enjoyed him. There's so much more to him than I think people give him credit for because he did have more of an eclectic role in movies. He could play the playboy or the father later on. Or there was one movie that I really liked called Uncle Vanya. It was a adaptation of the Chekhov play, and he actually directed it too. And because he was a trained theater actor, this is the one time you actually see what he would have been like on the stage had you been alive in the 30s. That's what I really enjoyed about it, because he really took this art seriously. And that is something, if you read about him, you'll learn, because of when he was married to Joan Crawford, he encouraged her to go to the theater. So that was a really cool discovery.
I can tell you, as you are well aware, I am not a Franciotone fan. I refer to him with the derogatory word in front of his name that I'm not going to say on the podcast. And it's not because of his relationship with Joan Crawford. I just don't like him as an actor. And I think that you brought that up. He does play the same type of role. And I'm starting to think maybe it's a look thing, too, because I tend to think he has the same look as Wesley Howard, who is another performer that I do not like. I'm wondering if it's just because they have that weird, tall, lanky weasel face. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
You know what's funny? When I was watching Franciotone, I was, this is Tom Hiddleston in 1930.
Yes.
Like, so boring looking. How does he have this underground group of fans?
Yes, exactly. What am I missing?
Yeah, because that's how I felt in the beginning. Because he was a big playboy. Reading about him, I was shocked. I was like, really? This guy, especially when you have the Clark Gables and Robert Montgomerys of that era, I was really surprised. The way he carries himself in films like Bride Wore Red or Girl from Missouri or Susie, he's so charming. I don't know. I really enjoy him. But again, I could totally see, like, for me, I cannot stand Leslie Howard either. I just want to, like, punch him in the face.
Thank you.
Him and Victor Mature, I just don't understand. And they're so opposite sides of the spectrum. Leslie Howard's so sensitive, and where Victor Mature is like so meaty. Tone it down. Really bizarre for me, but I totally understand. It was really interesting because I just didn't know about him. When I was writing about him on Twitter and on Instagram, a lot of people always said, I can't stand him. He's like Leslie Howard. And it's really funny. It's that type, for some reason, just grates people in a way. I am pro-Franciotone.
I am glad you were pro-Franciotone, because we are inclusive to all the classic film members. Francio and I, we're not friendly. My number five pick of the year that I discovered is a movie that I was actually inspired to seek out. I did an interview a couple years ago with Joan Kramer and David Healy, who are classic film documentarians. If you've seen a couple of their documentaries on TCM, they've done Fonda on Fonda. They did Katharine Hepburn in Her Own Words. They are great documentarians. They were gracious enough to let me interview them a couple years ago, and they put out a book. And Joan Kramer had recommended a movie called Fiesta from 1947. And the way she had described it to me was so amazing that I'm kicking myself that it took me 2 years after we did that interview for me to actually watch it. So I'm just going to lay out the plot. Fiesta is the story of a matador played by Ricardo Montalban who wants to focus on music, but his family is very knee-deep in the matador culture. His sister, Maria, his twin sister, played by Esther Williams, wants to be a matador. And she can't because she's a girl. Not because she looks like Esther Williams and her brother is supposed to be Ricardo Montalban, but because she's a girl. At a certain point in the movie, she decides to start imitating and dressing like her brother and becoming a matador on this underground circuit. I don't know what part of that makes sense to anybody else.
I think you also have to add that their mother is Mary Astor.
Their mother is Mary Astor. Their father is Fortunio Bonanova. Maria's intended is John Carroll, a man that she calls, his name is supposed to be Pepe. She calls him Pepe. Charisse is Conchita, who is Mario's, the girl that he's in love with. Mind you, you might be confused because he acts like he's also in love with his sister. So Fiesta is one of those movies that's so questionably weird that it's entertaining. I'm a ride or die for Esther Williams. So I will watch pretty much anything she's in and be like, yeah, it's the time period. You know, we didn't really hire Mexican actors to play Mexican roles. So I tend to chill for this, but oh my gosh. I don't know what part is more unbelievable. To me, it's when they put Esther Williams in her matador outfit. They put her in this pompadour shellac updo because she needs to have short hair. She looks nothing like Ricardo Montalban to begin with. So when she's got her hair up, she still doesn't look like him. And her matador suits, which they had to make custom, because I don't know if you know this, but women have boobs. So they had to make custom matador outfits for her. And her body shape is easily discernible. It is just a comedy of questionable errors. I mean, this is also the year I watched The Pirate for the first time. I don't know what faux Spanish movie I hate watched and loved more, whether it's this or Gene Kelly playing a Mexican scoundrel called Macoco. But either one is entertaining. Fiesta, though, it has all my favorite people. I mean, I love Ricardo Montalban and Esther Williams and Sid Charisse and On an Island with You, which is also questionable, but at least it's not vaguely racist. Either way, I mean, if you like Esther Williams, you already know going in this is going to be odd, but this is the oddest of the odd. So you've seen Fiesta.
I have. Being a Latina, I love these movies, actually, because it's like our one time. Because I love the Good Neighbor musicals from 20th Century Fox. For mm-hmm. the longest time, I thought Tyrone Power was Spanish and then didn't realize until I was like 11. Like, no, this is wrong. But I appreciate what they were trying to do because it's a celebration of the culture. Love the dance that Ricardo Montalban and Sid Charisse have. I think it's really beautiful and it's traditional. The best parts are when Esther Williams is actually in the matador ring and you see that hilarious special effects because that is not her.
Yeah, it's evident it is not her.
Yeah, it is so evident it's not her. They're not trying to make any statement. It's just fun and it's eye rolling. That's not what it really is. But at the same time, it was the World War II era. They just wanted to escape in places that people thought were like exotic and exciting. And so I take for it for what it's worth, but I do like the movie. I love the Technicolor. It looks gorgeous. Like it's a really beautiful looking movie.
It is. Richard Thorpe, who directed this, who Esther Williams did not like, directed several of her movies, including Thrill of a Romance and the aforementioned On an Island with You. I recommend watching this and On an Island with You back to back and just being baffled by the storylines that were invented by people.
Oh, God, that one is so weird. Like, I can't even really forgive it. I don't find it entertaining.
Oh, I do. You and I will have to, we will have to do an episode on an island with you because I go to bat. That movie is terrible, but I watch it every single time it's on. So, Diana, what is your number four pick?
So, my next pick is Patsy Kelly's performance in The Girl from Missouri. This was a movie that I watched during the great Fran Troutone binge watch, and I really didn't know what to expect. It's one of the movies that happened after the pre-code, after the code was initiated, but it still has some pre-codeness to it. It was my first introduction to Patsy Kelly, who is just so much fun. She was called the Queen of the Wisecracks, and I just adore her. So funny. I just found her in this movie incredible. Like, she just did whatever she wanted. It was amazing. I couldn't believe the moxie she had at this point in time. It was just really wonderful to watch. In the movie, she plays Jean Harlow's best friend, sidekick, fellow chorus girl. And she is so man hungry. It's hilarious. She's man hungry in a way where you celebrate her versus thinking, oh, she's such a slut or something. You know what I mean? Did you feel that way when you watched the movie?
It's been a long time since I've seen this movie. I watched this back when I first started my website. I feel like I need to re-watch this because it's not based on Harlow's life, but it did suffer from coming right at the beginning of the code, right?
Yeah, it was enacted. That's right.
So I remember watching it thinking, this movie wants so desperately to be saucy and risque, but you can see them having to tread this fine line between what was mm-hmm. accepted.
Exactly. You realize she's not just one of the other girls. She's actually a virgin still. It's so weird to me. But hey, it's 1934. Whatever.
It's just how they went.
How it happened.
And Patsy Kelly had 90 credits to her name and was in so many movies that I'm sure I've seen her in a bunch and just never realized it because she made 5 and 6 movies a year back when they could afford to do that.
In this one, compared to like some other ones, she's clearly like straight into it as like the man-hungry girl. And there was a scene where Jean Harlow, they're on a beach and she can't find her. And then when you see her, she's behind this boat and she comes up and her hair's tousled. And then there's this lifeguard who's tousled too. And so it's clearly implied what was going on behind that boat. But it is so funny.
I need to rewatch this again.
Not only has she got that subplot, but then she's also such a great friend to Jean Harlow. And I just love seeing their female friendship in these movies. Really enjoyed her. And then I ended up looking up what else she was been in. And I had no idea she was in all these movies that I love. And then later, she'll appear in Rosemary's Baby. It's so crazy. These pre-code actors would have such long careers.
Glad you brought it up. I have my Jean Harlow box set. I need to get the disc out and give it another try in spite of the Franchoiness.
I really feel like it's one of her best performances. She has that breakdown where he gets super aggressive and locks the door. And then she's like, you're not going to treat me this way. Obviously, right now, with everything that's going on, it's even more heartbreaking because that's 1934 and women are still treated this way. The way Jean Harlow stands up for herself is just such a powerful moment that you just feel for her. And it just makes the movie a lot more impactful than you really think it is.
Well, my number four is probably about as far from The Girl from Missouri as one can get. My number four is from 1941. It's The Devil and Daniel Webster. I saw this during Halloween because I was actually writing about differing depictions of the devil in cinema. So I had to watch a bunch of movies that had Satan in them. And this was one of the few from the pre-1950s era that was available. I tried to get Alias Nick Beale, and it turns out that that movie is not available on DVD. So I was really bummed to miss it because I wanted to watch it. But thankfully, I got to watch Devil and Daniel Webster, which is one of the kookiest, best-looking black and white movies that I can recall from the 40s. It's set in this 19th century New Hampshire town. It involves a farmer played by James Craig, who you might remember as being the guy in like a lot of Margaret O'Brien movies. The lantern jawed dude. He sells his soul to Mr. Scratch, played by Walter Houston, who is essentially the devil, gets all this money, but then has to give Mr. Scratch his firstborn at a certain point. Well, he doesn't want to do that. So Mr. Scratch's whole conceit is to get this politician, Daniel Webster, played by Edward Arnold, to turn corrupt. So the movie has these really weird plot threads because you assume that it's a very basic plot line about a guy who sells his soul to the devil, and then it turns into this concept of this hero of the common man who has to decide whether to sell his soul in order to save humanity. Very steeped in 1940s World War II nostalgia in terms of the greater good, and the government does have your best interest at heart. Really, though, it's watching the weird macabre elements of how scenes are filmed and how somber the movie is. You watch James Craig, who plays Jabez Stone, and his wife, Ann Shirley. They get all this money, but it's really watching the ultimate, oh, money corrupts, absolutely. He ends up just losing what makes him good. It's also got a great role for Simone Simon, who I love from Cat People. She plays Belle, who is essentially the devil's harlot. She just pops up in the movie and becomes Jabez's mistress. And she is so manipulative and evil, and I love it so much. And there's a really great, weirdly filmed moment that involves a party at the Stone Mansion. And you're under the impression that all these people have shown up, but Jabez doesn't know who they are and the audience doesn't see them. And that they're essentially people from hell who have shown up. It's, again, a very dark movie that is just light enough to not make you utterly depressed. And of course, much like the Powell and Pressburger film, A Matter of Life and Death, it culminates with a trial scene where Daniel Webster has to be the prosecutor for Jabez Stone's soul. And he has to go in front of this jury of the world's worst murderers. Like, one of them is not Genghis Khan. It's something like that. Like, Hitler isn't there, but it's this panel of horrible people. So it makes no sense how the ending works out, but that's what makes it a great movie. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend this because it's just a weird look at religion and faith, and it's dark, but it's also comical. It's a really great strain of black comedy. And Simone Simon is just luminous. Her introduction to this movie is probably one of the best scenes in just terms of how her face is lit. If you've ever wanted to see her at the apotheosis of her beauty, it is this film. Diana, have you seen this?
I haven't, but I really loved your series that you did. I thought that was really interesting because it's something that I wouldn't have thought to do. Reading all the films you chronicled, I was surprised that it's a theme that's been put a spotlight on way more often than I thought.
If you need to watch a movie about Satan from the studio era, do yourself a favor and watch this. Do not watch The Story of Mankind, which I did watch and I put in my article with Vincent Price playing the Mr. Scratch character. That is one of the worst movies I've seen. Do yourself a favor and watch Devil and Daniel Webster because it's very entertaining. Diana, what is your number three?
So my number three, this was a movie that I just had not gotten around to for the longest time, especially as someone who does like film noir. I've heard so much about it. I've seen some of the iconic scenes from it. And it's Gun Crazy.
I still need to see this.
This is so good. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. It is such a great movie. Peggy Cummins plays the female lead in this, and she is so hypnotizing. I just love her in this. John Dahl, which the only other movie I know him from is Rope, plays the male lead. I thought he was great in that movie, and he's so good in this as well. The story about it is John Dahl. It starts with his character as a child. He loves guns. Then he ended up going to juvenile delinquent center, has been there for a while, and comes out as John Dahl, an adult. And he and his buddies are like, oh, you know, I'm out. So let's go out on the town. And they go to a carnival. Because that's what you did in 1950, I guess.
It's either the carnival or the malt shop.
Yeah, exactly right. Not many other places. So they go to this carnival. He ends up hearing the gunshots and is like lured into this show. And it's Peggy Cummins, who is this really amazing sharpshooter. They have this incredible sexual tension just by looking at each other. Like, and you know it's happening because it's a film noir. She does one of these things where she pulls someone from the audience to join her in the carnival game. And so he does, and the tables are turned, and he has those things where the person stands and you have to shoot them, the outline of them. Well, of course he does that and it never hits her. And it's like, wow, you're good at this too. And so they fall in love.
There is so much sexual innuendo in that description.
Exactly. It's like, whoa, it's a crazy sequence. You know how classic movies, it's implied but also so in your face, that this movie does like such a good job of that. Peggy Cummins ends up manipulating him into this life of crime because she wants the finer things. She's not happy with what he can give her, and it's just such a fun ride. It's also so suspenseful. Another thing that I love about film noirs like this is that you root for these people even though they shouldn't be doing this. It's terrible. But Annie, who is the character Peggy Cummins plays, she is so good at being like so manipulative. But then you feel for her because she shouldn't be in this life anyway. I love the cinematography in this movie. It's so good. It's one of their big heist sequences. I just couldn't believe it was made in 1950. It's so well done, the way it cuts to certain shots, the victims. It pulls together, and just really enjoyed it.
I need to see this one. This one is one of many that I'm bummed I haven't gotten to yet. Considering one of the films is on my list, anything is possible. It's a landmark noir.
It's deserving of being a landmark noir. I remember hearing it for the first time by Martin Scorsese.
Right.
American Movie Classics did a film noir festival on television. This is one he constantly talks about. He talked about it then. It's in one of his books. So I'm really glad I hadn't seen it so quickly because I felt like I was removed from the hype, because sometimes I feel like that hinders a movie experience. So I really was glad that I watched it. For those who have Warner Archive Instant, it's on there.
Oh, but I have no excuse not to see it. Speaking of sexual tension, my number three is one of two movies on this list that you're going to say, how is it that you have gone a certain amount of time in your life and you've never seen this movie. I finally saw 1959 North by Northwest. I had never seen North by Northwest before this
Can
year.
Can we have like a huge drum roll for this moment?
Oh, just wait. There's a bigger drum roll coming.
Oh, I know.
This is the Alfred Hitchcock film that pretty much everybody touts as the best. I don't know if I could say it's the best. It's certainly the best encapsulation of the Hitchcock model. He's doing a lot of things with this movie that I really, really enjoy. I've actually watched this movie twice now. I actually wrote about it for TCM Backlot, which was really fun because I got to deconstruct some of the things that I really appreciated about this movie. In case you are like me and you had never seen it before, it follows Cary Grant, who plays Roger O. Thornhill, who is average Joe, who just happens to look like Cary Grant. He's an advertising executive who gets roped into a plot involving mistaken identity. Of course, there's a femme fatale, cool blonde played by Eva Marie Saint. There's a crop duster, a trip to Mount Rushmore, and James Mason being James Mason. And to say anything more about that, the plot just, I think, really ruins a lot of what makes the film so great. But I enjoy this movie, not necessarily for the set pieces. It's one thing to know, to hear about the Mount Rushmore set piece and the crop duster sequence. Those are great. And in terms of filmmaking and how Hitchcock utilized miniatures and forced perspective, I appreciate North by Northwest more from a character standpoint, because this movie is at times one of the sexiest Hitchcock movies I've ever seen. I'd say it's probably one of the sexiest movies that came out in 1959, because half the movie is just a train ride between Cary Grant's character and Eva Marie Saint's character. Their entire dialogue is just sexually tinged. It's not even tinged. It's overt. These two people want to get together. They're both beautiful. Eva Marie Saint has never looked better. But then when you introduce James Mason, who is not a man I have ever been into, there is a scene in this movie that involves a neck rub, and it is the sauciest, sweat-inducing moment on film. I watched this in a movie theater, and I was just like, whoo. Movie's hot. I don't know what to do. A 2-hour movie that never drags. I was riveted by everything that was happening, because yes, it's a little questionable in how things make sense, but Hitchcock is just lobbing things at you. And there's these characters that are so colorful, and the color itself is beautiful. You are just like Roger throughout the entire movie saying, what the hell is going on here? I mean, it helps that he looks like Cary Grant. This is a movie that I continue to be entranced by. It's amazing. So I'm glad that I finally got to see it. This is where Diana says, finally.
I love North by Northwest. This is the one I show people as the first Hitchcock movie they should watch. I really believe that this is the one that takes everything he was good at and puts it on the screen in such a perfect way. I think it's his best. I don't know which one I think is his best, because that's such a hard thing, especially, you know, when you have such an amazing oeuvre that he did. But it's just a fun ride. Whereas like some Hitchcock movies are great, but they're not fun.
Some of them just feel very dour.
I love Strangers on a Train, but it's not fun.
Shadow of a Doubt is a great movie, but it's got moments where you're just, okay, I get it.
From a technical standpoint, what he was doing was so
revolutionary in a couple
scenes.
Yeah,
exactly. It's very revolutionary in so many ways. The crop duster scene is so iconic, but a lot of people don't know where it comes from. How did it lead to that moment in the movie? And when it does, it's so good. I also just really like the way Hitchcock worked with Ernst Lehman. And this is one of their films that he wrote. And they were just so good together with that dialogue and how they moved the story along with Hitchcock's direction. Martin Landau.
Who is so just playing a movie. Character that you're like, he's gay, right? This movie is just thirst. Everybody is thirsty for everybody else. And that's great.
Yeah, I love Martin Landau and James Mason together. That's another great Hitchcock thing where so many characters in the movies could go either way. Something that I think is really important that people don't talk enough about, because it still might be a little taboo, but he would push the envelope in that and Strangers on a Train. And I think you have to see that to understand his genius and the kinds of themes he was, you know, he's a risk taker, and that's what he was doing. Eva Marie Saint's clothing, she looks so beautiful, costume design in it. Also, Cary Grant's mom is hilarious.
She is so great. The movie is punctuated with humor in a lot of scenes. And you need that in order to just keep this from being like a 2.5 hour slog of watching poor Cary Grant be tormented from all angles, land and sea and air. Well, Diana, what is your number two?
I stumbled upon this movie not because of Franchotone. This was like after the Tone binge watch. TCM was doing a day of Marianne Hopkins movies. I was watching this early in the morning and The Stranger's Return came on. And I didn't know that this movie was not available on DVD and is actually really hard to find. Apparently, a couple TCM film festivals ago, this was one of the banner movies. I found that out later. Have you seen this one, by the way?
I have not.
It's from 1933. It's a King Vidor film. He's one of my favorite directors. I just really love what he did. He has such an amazing filmography. Marian Hopkins, who is another actress that this year I started watching her films. I have been missing so much.
You have. Marian Hopkins is one of my faves.
How have I been missing this? I saw Old Acquaintance because I love Betty Davis, but why did I not seek her out? I'm kicking myself. This is unacceptable. So she stars as a divorcee who is in New York, and she comes back home to the Midwest and visits her grandfather and his farm. It's really interesting the reception she gets from the locals that live there, especially the women. They're all like, who is this? They feel threatened. And she strikes up a friendship with a farmer, played by Franchotone, and he's married to, of course, a perfect woman who would do everything for him. He'll come home and she has a home cooked meal and she's probably knitting his sweater for them. You know what I mean? She's just that perfect person in a pre-code movie. So you know something's going to happen.
So you know she's boring. You want the risk taker to get him.
And they have a perfect son, of course. I was really impressed by this movie. It's so funny because the premise is so simple. Lionel Barrymore plays her grandfather, and he is just so wonderful. He's such a curmudgeon. He owns this huge farm. It's a really sweet movie, and Marian Hopkins is just wonderful in it. It's one of those films of the theme of like finding your roots. Weren't expecting to. Her and Franchotone have this beautiful chemistry where she's another woman, but you don't feel like
she's a homewrecker.
Yeah, but you don't feel like that because she awakens things in him that he had been putting aside before he went into farming. He was very much into plays and theater, and he was like an artist. And then he realized, I'm not going to have a life, so I'm going to be a farmer and get real money. Their scenes together where she brings that out of him are just really beautiful because they're kind of things that you would see in real life. And that's what I loved about this movie is that there's no like great, huge climactic moment in it. It's just ordinary people. I can't really describe it. I reached out on Twitter. I was like, guys, I just discovered Marian Hopkins. I know, I'm an idiot. I don't know why it's taken so long. And I said that I had seen this movie, and there were so many people that said it was a lesser known gem and they really loved it. If you get a chance to watch it, I think TCM is airing it sometime next year. I want to say early in like January. Definitely seek it out because it's really hard to find. I'm so bummed that it doesn't have a DVD release because it's a really beautiful movie. It's a movie you don't see anymore.
So this came out during a string of hits that Marian Hopkins had. She had done Trouble in Paradise in 32, which is probably my favorite Marian Hopkins movie. She's so great in that. Story of Temple Drake in 33. She did Stranger's Return the same year. And then she did Design for Living right after that.
All different.
They are all different.
I feel like this one is the most different of the bunch because it's not like exciting and flashy. It's in the Midwest and they're farmers.
And this was a woman who played Becky Sharp in a Victorian drama 2 years later. I love Marian Hopkins. Actually, just got the new biography that Alan Ellenberger wrote about her. I am eager to get more of my Marian.
It was funny because I think the movie after this was Jekyll and Hyde, which I had no idea how racy that movie is.
Yeah, Jekyll and Hyde was actually 2 years before.
It was earlier because she looked significantly younger, but she is so heartbreaking in that movie.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful performance, and I was so impressed by her. And I hadn't seen that before either, and I could not believe that movie.
She is amazing in that movie. Well, my number two is something that people are going to roll their eyes and say, finally, up until a week ago, I had never seen Citizen Kane. Right at the 11th hour, I got to watch it. So I have officially seen Citizen Kane. Woo!
Go, Kristen!
I'm only, you know, a couple decades too late. I finally saw Citizen Kane. Part of why I shied away from watching it for so long was that I had been told that if I was going to watch it, you have to watch it four times. You have to watch it once, just as is. Then you have to watch it with this commentary. And then I got told, no, you have to watch it with this commentary. And then you have to watch it again after you know all these things. And I was like, that seems like a lot of work to watch one movie. The whole need to watch it academically really colored wanting to see it. But I finally did see it. Is it the best movie ever made? From an aesthetic standpoint, I would say sure. For me personally, I definitely enjoyed it. I think the problem is that I had seen so many clips from it and I had read so much about Wells and the making of it that I felt I had seen this without seeing it, if that makes sense. It's beautiful to look at. I love what the cinematographer does with certain shots showing the ceilings, filming some scenes from a pit, the weird mirroring imagery, the endless corridors, stuff like that. It's technically astounding. Even the plot is really engaging. Orson Welles has never been better, I think, as a performer than he is here. Joseph Cotten, Dorothy Kormingor broke my heart as Susan Alexander, especially if you know her real-life story after making this movie. It's a landmark film. I don't know if that landmark film necessarily means that I'm in love with it, but I am glad that I saw it. So I feel like people can stop giving me flack for not seeing it. How do you feel about Citizen Kane, Diana?
I'm in the same boat. It is a great story and it's told effectively. And it's always been great about watching it is you see the influence in so many different movies. You're just like, oh, wow, this is so common now. But this is probably the first time they did it. And just the risk he took, the statement he was making with this character, it was so ahead of his time. And he was 25. Thanks for making me feel like, nothing.
Yeah, I've accomplished nothing in my life.
I enjoy it from that standpoint. It's not a favorite movie of mine, but I can see where the argument is made because of how influential it is. But I also feel like it's one of those where it's not like a Casablanca where you want to watch it because there's certain moments in Casablanca that I just love and I feel like I'm visiting an old friend, that comfort, I have such an emotional attachment to it. Whereas Citizen Kane, I just don't. It doesn't affect me that way. I find that with a lot of Orson Welles' work. I love The Lady from Shanghai, but I'm not going to watch it.
I watch The Lady from Shanghai every time it's on. That's mostly okay, Hayworth, though.
But that's what I mean. I want to watch it because of her, because she's so hypnotizing and amazing.
Welles has a cachet as being this legendary filmmaker and that you have to analyze his films every frame. You have to pay attention. I'm not discouraging active viewing. You should watch every movie by paying attention to it. Orson Welles gets so many academics who are like, you have to really get into the nitty gritty of his work, but it does turn off the casual viewer.
That's part of it. I think it's mostly for me intimidation. I love The Third Man, but if I watch it, I'm going to have to spend hours on end thinking about it later.
And if I don't, you know, there's something wrong with me.
So you feel like you're not up to par intellectually to like get it, even though it's just a movie. So maybe I think that's probably my biggest conflict with his work. I do appreciate him. He turned the tables.
So Diana, what is your number one classic film discovery of 2017?
I'm going to call this more of a rediscovery because I hadn't seen this movie in a really long time. One of the best things of the year, combustible 2017 as it was when Jennifer Jones was named Star of the Month for Turner Classic Movies in September. I am ride or die Jennifer Jones. I think she is so good and so underrated. It really breaks my heart how divisive she is because of the Robert Walker marriage and the fact that she was such a private woman. Nobody really knows the real Jennifer Jones, but nobody seems to care because they cast her as this villain in this horrible story. But at the same time, she didn't come out victorious in it either. She was very much manipulated. Anyone who has heard anything about Jennifer Jones doesn't really know what they think about her should go to You Must Remember This's website and download the podcast about her, David O. Selznick and Robert Walker, because it's such a great comprehensive account of what was actually happening that we know of. If you do that, maybe you can get rid of your bias and enjoy her, because she is such a versatile actress. I watched Portrait of Jenny. Have you seen this movie?
I have, yes.
It's such a good movie that isn't talked about as much as it should be. I think her relationship with Joseph Cotten, they made 4 films together. They were so good together. I feel like he just knew there was just this mutual respect that you see on the screen between them, and he knew what was good for her. A lot of her performances, or her characters rather, are like mysterious women that you kind of don't know how you feel about them, but you're drawn to them. She has such a unique, striking face with her big cheeks. Someone once described them as like apple cheeks, which I'd never heard before, but it makes sense. But she was just a unique beauty when you compare her to her contemporaries. She's a mysterious character. It's such a unique story that I don't think with any other actress, it would have been as effective as her, because she was so good at projecting this childlike innocence and then growing as a woman. I just love that displayed in this film. That's something that's also displayed in Since You Went Away, where she's a teenager and then as the war hits, she becomes this army nurse. And she was just so good at these well-rounded characters and seeing them grow. The ending of Portrait of Jenny is just so heartbreaking. I just remember I watched it, and I watched it again because I just loved it so much. It's just such a beautiful movie.
Jennifer Jones is one of those actresses. I love her. I think there's a real ethereal quality to her. She's got this lack of guile. There's no artifice. You don't feel like she's an actress in a lot of scenes. I always show for The Song of Bernadette, if you haven't seen that. It's my favorite Jennifer Jones movie because I think it encapsulates what made her so enticing for good and bad to people. If you haven't seen a Jennifer Jones movie, there are good ones out there. Do not let the haters dissuade you from enjoying some of her work.
It is hard because from that string of The Song of Bernadette to probably Love is a Many Slender Thing.
Yeah.
Those are the only good movies. And Love is a Many Slender Thing I love, but I can totally see why others don't.
I'm there for the William Holden in little short swim trunks. That's what I'm there
for. Yeah, and I totally get that it's super sentimental and his, you know, a lot of his dialogue is very saccharine, and I totally get that. But I just think they have such a great chemistry there. There's just something about it. I'm very much drawn to it. I think up until that point, she had such a great run of movies. Unfortunately, like after that, it's just not good. I obviously blame David O. Selznick because he was losing his mind. He wasn't even getting her good work, just trying to get his legacy, which is unfortunate because I think she did some of her best work without him. It's just sad that we'll never know because he was so controlling. If you watch her films without knowing certain things, you can really see what was so great about her, because she was a very complex actress than more people give her credit for.
Well, my number one is not Citizen Kane, obviously, which I'm sure people are already freaking out about. But my number one is actually a movie that I saw at the TCM Classic Film Festival in 2017. This was one that I did not think I was going to get to, because there was a prior obligation, and then that ended up following through, and I was like, well, I'm here, so I guess I'll just go see this. And it's the 1967 romantic comedy Barefoot in the Park, which has now become one of my favorite movies, and Warner needs to get on it and re-release it on DVD, because DVDs are really expensive for this movie because it's out of print. Warner Archive, if you're listening, do me a favor, re-release this movie. Thankfully, you can stream it on Netflix. Barefoot in the Park is one of those great 60s romantic comedies that came out. If you've seen something like Sunday in New York, that also has Jane Fonda in it, which Robert Redford auditioned for and did not get it, it's almost like a retread of Barefoot in the Park, just came out first. So this movie tells the story of a newlywed couple, the Bratters, Paul and Corey, played by Robert Redford and Jane Fonda. He is this buttoned-up conservative lawyer. She is this vivacious free spirit. They have this quick courtship and marriage, and then the honeymoon ends very quickly, and they have to get into the nature of domesticity. So they get this New York City walk-up apartment, and it all comes to a head when they realize that it's 5 flights up and down, and that there's no heat, and that there's a hole in the skylight, and that the bedroom is too small for them to actually put a bed. So there's this comedy of domestic errors that plays out. And of course, their neighbor is played by Charles Boyer as an older man who is very into Corey and also just plays on this Charles Boyer French lover type of character that he had cultivated. I've watched it several times since I came back from the film festival, and it's funny. It's sexy. For 1967, the opening first 5 minutes of this movie is watching a door of the hotel room as newspapers pile up. And Robert Redford leaves the bedroom looking completely drained of blood. It's hilarious. And they have this real sexual chemistry. It's not this romantic love, although they do love each other. But this is one of those movies I can recall as the studio system would crumble that showed that there was more to love than just being really fond of each other. Like, these two people are getting it on. I mean, it helps that they look like Jane Fonda and Robert Redford. This is also the movie where I noticed that Robert Redford could be funny. If you've only ever seen him in dramas, you're missing out on his talent. I mean, most of the humor is derived from the fact that he's snooty and boring. But there's a lot of funny one-liners. A lot of his reactions to things are really funny. Mildred Natwick plays Jane Fonda's mother, and she is the MVP of this movie because her entire performance is just being emotionally spent. So just walking up the 5 flights to their apartment, she throws herself on the couch and says, "I feel like we've died." A lot of her lines are things like I would say. It's wacky. It's sweet. It's such an enjoyable movie. A lot of movies as the 60s would end and the 70s would start, you expect a lot of movies from that time period to be very gritty and very serious. And they would be as the 70s started. But this is just a really great, sweet rom-com that is a high watermark for romantic comedies. It only shows you how romantic comedies get it wrong nowadays. If you have not seen this, I cannot stress enough watching this movie. If anything, watch it for Robert Redford's coat, because his coat is just so amazing in this movie. He looks phenomenal. I, too, would be like Jane Fonda and just on him all the time. It was 1967. Have you seen this?
I have, yeah. I actually saw it this year for the first time, too, which is kind of funny.
Worth discovering on its, what, 50th anniversary?
The funny thing about it, too, is when I was at the TCM Film Festival, I met Kate Gabrielle in person, another blogger, and she's the one who does all the amazing classic
right.
movie art and pins. If you don't know, go on her website, kategabrielle.com.
Yes, yes.
She told me that her favorite feel-good movie is Sunday in New York. And she was talking to me about it because this film, Barefoot in the Park, was playing at the TCM Film Festival. I didn't get to see it there, but I got to see it when I got back. I think I went on Netflix and saw it. And they keep showing Sunday in New York randomly on TCM. So I was able to catch it this year. And they're so great to watch together because they're in New York. They have beautiful apartments and stuff.
They're very similar in terms of the wacky hijinks that come from being married, apartment living, and dealing with your neighbors. There's a lot of commonalities.
For those of us who've grown up with Jane Fonda, not from the 60s, but know her from her workout videos, it's just so great to revisit her when she first started out. And this is, you just appreciate her so much more because she is a queen. She's amazing. And her and Robert Redford are great. And didn't they just reunite this year?
They did. They made a movie that you can also watch on Netflix called Our Souls at Night. I have not seen it, but I want to because I think that's their third movie together. They also had done, they did 4 movies together. They had done The Electric Horseman after this, and then they had done The Chase before Barefoot in the Park. So they've done 4 movies together.
They're like one of our last couples that are still with it.
Any honorable mentions you want to throw out, things that you would have recommended, but we just didn't have time?
Well, Noirvember, I watched movies that I just hadn't seen before, like exclusively, and some that I hadn't seen before. One that I really should have gotten to sooner, and it's In a Lonely Place. Have you seen it?
I have not, but I know I need to.
It's so good. I think that's on Filmstruck, so I highly recommend that. It's a great, great movie, especially it's one of Bogart's last, and he is so good. And Gloria Graham, I just had not really appreciated, because I think I'd only seen like The Greatest Show on Earth, which is horrible, and The Bad and the Beautiful, obviously she's amazing. I just really appreciate her so much more for this movie. So that's one that I really enjoyed. There was a Jean Tierney, Jose Ferrer film called Whirlpool that is a film noir. It's a psychological thriller too that I enjoyed. I don't think we talk about Jose Ferrer enough. He's so good. He's such a sinister, cerebral character in this, but it's still very much a film noir, and it surprises you. Another one that I stumbled upon It's a very lesser known William Holden movie that he made when Columbia Pictures was trying to figure out what to do with him. And it's called The Dark Past. It's really bizarre because it's another Freudian film where he's, I don't want to call him a gangster, but he basically holds hostage Lee J. Cobb's family, and Lee J. Cobb plays his psychiatrist. It's a very short movie. I think it's only an hour. I just really enjoyed it because it was very different than what I expected. It's not the best movie he's done, but I think it's one where you appreciate his career trajectory and the fact that Billy Wilder came in because he saw his promise in this movie. And you see that, and then you see Sunset Boulevard. You really appreciate what was happening and how he was given the chance to really show his talent.
My recommendation, totally forgot I saw An Affair to Remember for the first time this year. That would have easily been my six if we had six. I would also throw out another Jane Fonda movie, The China Syndrome. I saw that at TCM, and it's really timely today. I would throw out the Joel McRae film Bird of Paradise from 1932. It's a weird, exotic Islander movie, but it's really funny to watch Joel McRae ride a turtle into the fray. You should watch it for that. I'd also recommend the Margaret O'Brien film Music for Millions, one of the few Margaret O'Brien movies that I have not seen from 1944, another Henry Koster movie that is really charming. Margaret O'Brien, Marcia Hunt, June Allison, that is undone by the horrible, annoying performance of Jimmy Durante, who I find ruins every movie he's in. Sorry to the Jimmy Durante fans in there. Let me know your thoughts on your classic film discoveries that you saw this year. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank once again Diana Bosch for joining me today. Diana, where can fans find and get in touch with you online?
I blog at Flickin' Out, and that is wordpress.com, and it's /Flickin', it's F-L-I-C-K-I-N, out. And you can find me on Twitter at The Dame Upstairs, which is a reference to Double Indemnity. So you can press your friends. I'm also on Instagram at flickin_out without a G. As some of you know, if you know me from Twitter, you know that I'm a huge William Holden fan. And next April is his centennial. So on the blog, we're doing I'm looking for writers who want to contribute to talk about his legacy. So you can email me. You can find my email address on my website. Just reach out if you're interested. It'd be great. It's going to be for several months. It'll start January 1st.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating or review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn about upcoming episodes, vote in exclusive polls on content, or actually get to listen to content before everyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Patrons already had exclusive access, but you can now go over to Patreon and listen to my interview with Alexandra Dean, director of Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story, as well as learn about the stars I'll be spotlighting all year for Ticklish Business's centennial celebration. Not sure what that is? Well, this year will consist of episodes honoring stars who turn 100 in 2018. So if you'd like to know the full roster of stars, you can head over to Patreon, where that is available now for everyone, regardless of whether you're a patron or not. Patrons, though, can vote in an exclusive poll, though, right now, for which star is going to be honored in February. So if you'd like to vote, consider donating to my Patreon page. Regardless, next time, Ticklish Business is going to kick off Centennial Celebration, honoring composer Leonard Bernstein and discussing the quintessential Romeo and Juliet musical, West Side Story. Till next time. Thank you.